Some of the most necessary and important things around us are so common that we stop even noticing them or thinking about them. But when it comes to something as vital as soil, we really need to take the time to pay attention and to keep it healthy. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Miller. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for another edition of Garden Talk. Kevin Schesso is the Area Agriculture Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. He has a special interest in soil ecology and composting, having gotten both his MS and BS in soil science from UW-Madison and UW-River Falls. So when you want to talk about soil, Kevin is the person to do it. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to Garden Talk.
Good morning, Judith. It's a pleasure.
It's so good to have you with us again. And I know that there's going to be a lot of interest in this topic because it really is, soil really is kind of where we all have to start in having a healthy garden, isn't it?
Well, I think anybody who gardens or farms realizes the importance of this resource and does not take it for granted. And that's why I'm such an advocate for it. It's so important to our everyday lives, and a lot of people don't always think about that.
So really, what is soil? I think, you know, often we think of soil and dirt as the same thing, but soil is really complex, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. It's a quite dynamic, diverse ecosystem, as we like to say in soil science terms. But I think anybody who gardens knows that soil is got all kinds of unique properties that makes it do what it does. It's almost magical in some ways. And as we peel back the layers of that onion, so to speak, we learn that there's so much there that we don't know and we need to appreciate.
So how does soil come to be? How is that, you know, how does that magical material?
Yeah, you want to talk soil sex here?
Huh? Sure.
Where does soil come from? The birth of a soil? Well, I think everybody knows that there's mineral deposits, sand, silt, and clay that make up the physical part of soil. And that's what we often refer to as the parent material that most all of our soil is derived from. And this is soil that's spread out on the landscape, soil that's in our backyards and that's in our raised beds or in our containers. That sometimes can be manipulated and be more of an artificially enhanced medium. But the soil that's on our landscapes is goes back to our geology of the region, and soils are unique all across the world as a result of that parent material and the climate that they formed in. And in Wisconsin, of course, we have just an abundance of soil types because of our geology, and a lot of that geology is based off of the glaciers that went through the state. So that that's what makes Wisconsin unique from a lot of other parts of the U.S.
So looking at Wisconsin, there is the Driftless area, which was not affected by glaciers, and much of the rest of the state was. How big are the differences in the soil in those two types of areas?
Well, you know, to the casual observer, they may not seem very significant. But, you know, in general, the soils in the Driftless area were derived from bedrock and erosional, activities from, hundreds and hundreds of years of erosion on that bedrock-type landscape. And so there's depositional soils down in the valleys, and those tend to be very deep and dark. We call those alluvial soils. And then, of course, on the hilltops and on the plateaus, the soils might be a little shallower, again, because of the bedrock that kind of controls the landscape. So from that standpoint, you can have quite a difference in soil type from one position in the landscape to another, versus in areas that were glaciated, where the glaciers went and they kind of bulldozed and mixed up all that material. You get maybe a little bit more uniform and larger areas that are more common. But either way, I think we still have really fertile, productive soils in the Wisconsin, whether you're talking the Driftless region or other parts of the state.
So given what you said about how soil is formed and comes into being, is soil considered a renewable resource?
Yes, I think most people would agree that soil building and soil formation is happening all the time. It's just at a very, very slow rate. It's estimated that it takes maybe 300 to 500 years to produce 1 inch of topsoil. So we know that through the biology and the chemistry and the physical properties that happen in soil, the soil is always changing and being, you know, rejuvenated and building, if you will. So we know that soil does change and we can produce more of it. It's just at a very slow rate.
We're talking with Kevin Shesso. He's the Area Agriculture Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. We're going to learn a lot about soil today, but Kevin can also answer other garden questions as well. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Cheryl Gasser is our on-air producer today. So, Kevin, you use the word dynamic in talking about soil, and to me, dynamic probably means that there's even more going on than all of those chemicals and minerals and materials. When you talk about healthy soil, what is in it that makes it healthy?
Well, when we use that term, healthy, I think we have to almost acknowledge that there's life there that needs to stay healthy. Just like people, other animals, ecosystems, we always use that word, healthy. So in soil, like I mentioned before, we've got physical properties, chemical properties, and biological properties, and it's that biology, the life that's in that soil, that accounts for about 80 to 90% of influences on that soil's ability to do what it's intended to do. So we're talking macro microorganisms and microorganisms, the ones you can see with the eye, like earthworms and mites and sow bugs and springtails. I think everybody is familiar with snow fleas. Those are those larger organisms that live in the soil and are part of that soil food web or that, ecosystem that exists, just like we have, a food web above ground that I think we all can acknowledge exists because we can see it. In the soil, other than these larger ones, earthworms are probably the most, commonly recognized, but there's so many more organisms that we just have no clue about, the average person, and that would be, of course, bacteria, and there's good bacteria and, obviously bad bacteria, but fungus, actinomycetes, there's amoebas, just a whole host of these really tiny, tiny microscopic organisms that are down in the soil doing their thing, creating this, again, very diverse, resilient media. And it's the biology that really gives the soil its health.
I was down in Chicago a couple of weeks ago and got to spend several hours at the Field Museum. And one of their exhibits, which I will admit is definitely geared towards children, but I marched in there and enjoyed it myself, is called Underground Adventure. And it is built to give humans the perspective of being a half inch tall and going underground and seeing all of those things that you just mentioned, all of the little mites and the earthworms and the sow bugs, which of course are gigantic when you're a half inch tall. And so you can walk through and get a little sense at least of how much is going on in that soil that we really are just not aware of.
That's right. And that's, I think, the beauty of public radio and being in education is that you can explain that to people and get them to think a little bit more critically about, what is going on beneath our feet. And out of sight, out of mind is, so common. And we just need to really have that appreciation that there is all kinds of life and habitats that are happening, in the soil, and that's what makes it, such a critical resource.
We're going to get back to talking about how to make our soil healthy or what makes it unhealthy, but Diane in Milwaukee is on the line, so let's go there right now. Hi, Diane.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering what the effect of having ash from my fireplace would be if I put it into our garden.
Oh, wood ash is a wonderful amendment. One of the things I caution anytime we talk about adding an amendment or anything to our soils is just to reflect back on the source and the quality of that amendment that you're putting into your soil. You know, obviously, if it's a vegetable garden, you know, there could be some impacts of contaminants that would, you know, be taken up by the plants or come in contact. But wood ashes, if it's coming out of a standard, you know, wood-burning stove and you're not using, you know, you're not burning garbage or certainly any waste products like, you know, used oil and those kinds of things, but just straight wood, we know that ash that's resulting in that has all kinds of minerals and other compounds that are beneficial to the soil. Wood ash is well known for the potassium or the potash, and it also has phosphorus. There's trace minerals, magnesium, zinc, calcium. But the other part of wood ash is it has lots of carbonates. And carbonates are what neutralizes the acid in the soil. So wood ashes are a wonderful soil amendment if you need to make your soil less acidic. But I do caution that if you add too many wood ashes, the pH of your soil can be raised higher than it needs to be, and that's where we need to, you know, have a soil test to monitor that. So wood ashes are a wonderful amendment. Again, just like anything, you have to monitor it and know when to stop.
Thanks for that call, Diane. And actually, that was a perfect segue to, you know, we're talking about how to make our soil healthy, but how do we know if it is healthy or not? You just mentioned soil testing.
Yes. You know, for I don't say 100 years now, you know, our soil scientists and our universities have been studying soil and trying to relate different chemical extractions in laboratory settings where they can extract plant-available nutrients. And there's been a whole generation of scientists that have worked on that and come up with appropriate methods to test the soil. And from that information, we can make recommendations on what does that mean. So if you do get your soil tested at a laboratory, either a private or a public lab, one of the things you'll get back is the pH of the soil, and that, you know, relates to the acidity. And, you know, we know that certain plants do not do well when the soil gets below, say, a pH of 5.5 or 6. If you're growing blueberries or rhododendrons, of course, we know they love acid soil, so therefore a pH of 4.5 would be good. So pH is just one of those elements or tests we can do, but we also can, you know, make recommendations on the amount of those macronutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and of course all kinds of micronutrients we can test for as well. And again, the research that has been done, we can then relate the amounts of those nutrients that are in a soil test back to recommendations on what to do to make improvements.
And Kevin, I obviously it's a great idea to get our soil tested. Do we need to test soil from different parts? I mean, if we have a, you know, small to medium yard, do we need to do several tests from different parts of it? And how often should we test? I mean, if it says our soil needs X, Y, or Z today and we add it in, you know, is that good for 10 years or do we need to monitor it?
Right. Well, some of it depends on the crop you're growing and how closely you need to monitor that. Certainly farmers who are growing high-value crops, some of our processing vegetables and fruit crops, they need to monitor those nutrients and be a little bit more timely in doing that. So they might do it every 3 years. 2 or 3 years maybe. But for the average homeowner, home gardener, and even for a lot of our crop farmers, every 3 to 5 years is typically what we suggest for just, you know, checking in, seeing where the soil test is and if it's changed or not. As far as collecting a sample, all you're going to be sending in is about 2 cups worth of soil to be tested. And that 2 cups has to represent whatever area you are interested in getting recommendations for. So the more representative that sample can be, the better, you know, the more useful it's going to be for you. So if it's just a raised bed garden box, well, then you only have to take, you know, soil from within that raised bed. Mm-hmm. But if it's a backyard for like a lawn situation, then you want to take multiple subsamples kind of in a zigzag pattern across that yard And put those into a bucket, mix it up, and then, you know, put that into your soil testing bag. So a sampling is a critical part of soil testing, and it has to be representative of what you want recommendations back on.
And how far down do you go to get the sample?
Well, again, we know that most of the biology and most of the organic matter and all the characteristics that influence our soil tests and, you know, the research, again, has been based in that top soil layer. So it's typically the depth of tillage in a garden situation. You know, if you're running a rototiller, that might be 6 or 8 inches. In a lawn situation, we typically go down about four to six inches, not quite as deep. So again, it's whatever that mixed zone would be where the majority of our plant roots are going to be feeding.
We are talking with Kevin Schesso. He's the Area Agriculture Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. And he has a special interest in soil ecology and composting, but he can also answer your general gardening questions as well. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and this is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mark your calendars, because coming up on Garden Talk on December 5th, sisters Astrid and Sonia Neuenhaus share their annual list of great gifts for gardeners and those trying to live more sustainably. That's coming up 2 weeks from now. But right now, we're talking with Area Agriculture Development Agent for UW Extension, Kevin Schesso. We're talking a lot about soil health, but also about your garden questions as well. You can join in 1-800-642-1234. So, Kevin, what kind of things make soil unhealthy? Is it just when things get out of balance, or, you know, what are some of the worst deficiencies that our soil might have?
Yeah, well, again, this gets back to how do you define health and what is a healthy soil, and some of it's subjective. I mean, we talk about health in people, and, you know, we have all kinds of different ideas about what is unhealthy. But I think for the most part, you know, soil that has that resilience and diversity, you know, is going to maintain its productivity. It's going to have high water holding capacity. It's going to, you know, not be compacted. So I think when we start to do practices that take away some of those desirable characteristics in the soil, that's when we start stressing that soil environment and making it a little bit more challenging for those microbes and, you know, that underground food web to do its thing. And that's when we run into, you know, some of the challenges with maybe erosion on, again, we're talking more on landscape fields, but even in your backyard garden, I mean, if you've got plants that don't look healthy and aren't thriving, you know, maybe it is a compaction issue. Maybe, you know, we've got a soil that's deficient in something because, you know, we haven't been adding organic matter to replace the nutrients that are removed when we harvest a crop. So I think just by looking at the soil and looking at the plants that grow on it, we can tell whether or not our soil is, you know, doing what it needs to. Just like in people, I mean, if we wait till we have real obvious symptoms, then, you know, it's, I don't say too late, but you know, that tells us that something's not right.
Let's go back to the phones, and Bill in Marshfield is up first. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm coming through okay?
Perfect.
Oh, this is a great show. I'm excited because just recently, in the last couple of years, I've been interested in vermiculture and vermicomposting, use of worms, and I've read quite a bit about it. There seems to be some research, and I think it's kind of nirvana for the average gardener. But also, I would think that there's municipal and agricultural applications, and I'd like to hear your guest comment on that, and I'll take my comments off the line.
All right. Thanks, Bill. And I have to say, I am a vermicomposter, and so is Cheryl, our on-air producer.
Wonderful. we're moving forward, right? Vermicomposting, for those that don't know what that means, it's just a fancy term for using worms and worm castings in your garden. So you've got a worm bin, and, you know, food scraps go in there, and you're farming those worms. It's a special type of worm, usually a red worm, that you know, eats all that organic material and mixes it up with the newspaper or other material you have with the food. And what comes out the other end, of course, is the worm poop. And it's that, again, you're running that organic matter through that worm's digestive system. And in the process, it's changing the chemical and the biology of, you know, of that castings of the poop. And like all manures, there's all kinds of nutrients and other microorganisms and structures that improve our soil. There's a compound called glomulin that is responsible for holding soil particles together. It's like a glue. It's a biological glue. And it's these microorganisms like worms that produce this stuff. Mm. And that's what holds our soil together and keeps it nice and soft and fluffy and, you know, gives it that that tilth that you may have heard about. So worms are, again, we're intentionally using worms to do what they've always done. And, again, we're just being a little bit more concentrating our efforts on doing that. So, again, we're talking about a natural fertilizer, natural compounds full of all kinds of exudates and nutrients that, you know, Mother Nature, you know, provides us. And that's where the worm castings and using worms to improve our soil is. So it's just one of many techniques we can use. And if you're not adverse to having live worms sitting under your kitchen sink.
Mine are in the basement.
It's fascinating.
And Cheryl's are in the basement, too. Well, we've had Joe Van Rossum on from mm-hmm. Extension, who he does solid waste recycling and also worm composting. We've had him on the show before, and that's a good reminder that maybe we should have him on again. And I think it's a great project to do with kids, too, because they can really develop an appreciation for how complex these ecosystems are.
Oh, yes. I've seen school gardens and school programs using vermicomposting for many years now, and you're right. It's very eye-opening, hands-on. I mean, what kid wouldn't like to see a bucket full of worms doing their thing? So,
and also that those worm castings are so concentrated. I mean, it's really a much more powerful fertilizer and amendment than like composted manure that you buy.
Yes. I mean, again, it's all on how you look at the end product. I mean, each of these organic materials, whether they be, you know, homemade compost, leaf mold, cover crops, your traditional horse, cow, sheep, chicken manures, worm castings, they all have, you know, their unique characteristics and can enhance our soil. And it's, again, that diversity that I like to promote. And I don't necessarily put one above or, you know, the other. And, you know, you're right. I mean, it is a wonderful material, and there's all kinds of benefits that come from it. You know, but like a lot of our organic fertilizers, they tend to be fairly low in total concentration of nutrients compared to, say, a commercial fertilizer that's, you know, much higher concentrated in one particular nutrient. But they're devoid of all that biology and all those other, you know, mm-hmm. unique chemical compounds that come with an organic you know, fertilizer.
It's kind of like the difference between getting your vitamins and minerals from food versus a pill.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Let's go back to the phones and Sue in Appleton. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is a garden question. I have a small city lot, and I have a black walnut tree that canopies my whole backyard. And my husband planted me a raised bed garden 2 years ago, and it produced vegetables. Not great, but it did okay. And this last year, it started to grow. And, you know, one weekend we came home from being away, and it was almost like something was sprayed on my entire garden, and it all died. It completely produced nothing. And I'm thinking, you know, is it that black walnut tree? Do I have any hope of ever having a garden in that yard? You know, what can I, sort of cutting the, I'm told doesn't, it won't help it anyway because of the roots in the ground.
Right. And I have to say, Sue, I am in exactly the same situation, except it's not my black walnut, it's my neighbor's. So I have even less that I can do about that, Kevin.
Yeah, and I think anybody who's listened to this show before is, you know, knows that black walnuts are one of those unique plants that has juglone, you know, that's in the sap and in the roots, and it's that juglone that interferes with other plants. It's kind of like the tree's natural defense. It's a allelopathy, and that's where we have to deal with how do you you know, either remove the jug loan, you know, build up the soil layer so that it doesn't come in contact with those root exudates or, you know, the leaves that might fall onto that garden plot. You know, and if you can't move the tree or you have a hard time preventing that, you're really hard-pressed to get around that other than, like I said, you know, going to raised beds, trying to get the roots of your plants away from the influence of that tree. You know, so that's the jug loan story. Anytime we see symptoms and signs and issues with our plants and in our gardens, a term I like to use, I use this all the time with my work with UW Extension, is you have to do horticulture CSI, crime scene investigation. You know, what are the sights and sound, what are you seeing on site? What are the evidence that you can put together to kind of build a case for what might be going wrong? And there's lots of issues that might be coming into play here. So I don't know, without asking you some more specific questions about, you know, to see your garden just, you know, wither, you know, over a weekend is quite unusual. But, you know, there's other factors that, you know, I guess we have to explore that might cause that. So I don't know if you have any other evidence of what may have happened there.
I think she's gone, but okay. I would offer a couple mm-hmm. suggestions. As I said, unfortunately, lots of experience with this. One thing, even though I know that she said that her husband just built new raised beds, I just built some new raised beds last summer, and what I did this time was I started out with paving stones first to really just make kind of an ironclad a barrier between the existing soil that I know has the jug loan in it and any, you know, contact with the roots, either as the plants are sending their roots down or as the tree roots are, you know, sending that jug loan out. So I started with paver stones and then built the raised beds on top of that. So fingers crossed, it was a pretty good year this year, and I'm hoping that that will at least take care of what's coming up from the bottom. I have had to pick out the leaves and the husks from the nuts and things like that. And the other thing is, you know, it's kind of maybe the more zen approach is grow what will grow near a black walnut. And UW Extension does have a very good handout on things that will grow near black walnuts. And it's not going to be the things like tomatoes and peppers and eggplants, but I have gorgeous black raspberries. Beans will do okay. Some squashes. So you might just have to go with what those growing conditions are.
Mm-hmm. No, those are excellent recommendations, observations from personal experience.
I wish I didn't have that personal experience, Kevin. It's been the bane of my gardening existence. But, you know, you do what you can. Let's go back to the phones and Bob in Monroe. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi.
How could we get along without public radio? It's wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much.
I've been dumping yard waste and burying my garbage behind my shop for quite a while. Unfortunately, I've also put treated grass clippings in there, and I'm wondering if there is a period of time that can pass to make that okay to use for compost, or have I killed it forever?
And when you say treated, what specifically has it been treated with?
Well, both with fertilizer and weed killer.
All right. Kevin?
Yeah, you know, this is one of those, you know, back to my earlier comments is, you know the quality and the source of the amendments you're putting onto your soil. And there is a downside to, you know, using some of these lawn byproducts and yard waste. And, you know, if you are using, in this case, maybe grass clippings that you know have been treated, the chemical fertilizer, the liquid fertilizers that are often sprayed and used on lawns, there's really no detrimental impacts of those. I mean, the chemistry there is pretty straightforward. You know, that'll get diluted out over time or maybe leached out. When we get to the herbicide questions, you know, those are larger-chained, organic, you know, carbon-based products that take a little bit more time to break down. There are organisms, again, getting back to that soil life, there are specific bacteria that can chew on that and break those chemical compounds into metabolites, but it's just a matter of how long that takes to do that and under what conditions. And some of these break down much more easily than others. So, you know, it's good that you're composting this stuff and letting it kind of, you know, mellow out and give the soil microbes a chance to break that down. But the only way you can know for sure whether or not there's any negative impacts from that that compost that's been made from treated yard waste would be to do a simple test with some of that material and try to grow. Well, pick an easy plant to grow, like radishes or maybe a tomato seedling. And, if those plants seem to thrive and do well, after that yard waste has been composted, that's an indication that, those compounds are maybe diluted out or have been removed. So that's just a little assay you can do to verify whether or not those compounds are still in that material. But that's always a question we have to ask is, what are the long-term implications of using some of these yard wastes that have been treated?
We are talking with Kevin Schesso. He is the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. We're talking a lot about soil health, but Kevin can also answer other garden questions as well. And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And Kevin, we've been talking about how to make a soil more healthy to add organic material. What happens if the soil is not healthy? Say, if you have a backyard garden of tomatoes, peppers, kind of the usual suspects. What will we see in a garden with healthy soil versus one where the soil is not as healthy?
Well, I think this gets back to just, what are the plants telling us? And I think most people who've, gardened and are fairly successful at it and have been, treating their soils well and adding organic matter, the plants are going to respond favorably. So, again, getting back to those comments about the physical and biological and chemical properties of soil, an unhealthy soil will probably not have, the nice, big, bushy, dark green plants that you'd expect, in a more successful, healthy soil. There may be, like I said, crusting and compaction issues. It may pond and not let water infiltrate. When you work it and touch it, or even smell it, one of the things that I think, anybody who works with soils know that, it does have a unique smell to it. And that's, again, that biology to the soil. And there are certain fungus that give soil that earthy smell. And that's what causes, that aroma. So, again, it's just going back to observational data or, things you can look at to tell you whether or not, you have healthy soil. And the plants will do that as well as the soil.
We had a question on Facebook from Bob saying we mentioned the driftless non-glaciated area of Wisconsin and asking what part of the state that refers to. And that's basically the southwest portion of the state, right, Kevin?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, anybody who travels around the state knows that you pick it up south of River Falls along the Mississippi River there. But then as you get down into La Crosse and Prairie du Chien and that whole, southwest corner, you'll notice the long valleys and it's just a total different landscape. As you drive through that area, and that's, again, because the glaciers didn't go through there and kind of smooth things out or change some of those, the bluffs and the mm-hmm. outcrops that are so common down that area.
It's really a beautiful part of the state.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking with Kevin Schesso about soil health and many other garden topics. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So glad to have you with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for Garden Talk. And so glad to have Kevin Chesso with us. He is the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. And he has a special interest in soil. So we've been talking a lot about that, but we can also cover other garden questions as well. And Kevin, going back to the topic of testing soil, Jen and Madison emailed to ask how to go about getting soil tested, how much it costs, and you know what you learn. And she asked, how often do you need to test it? But I think you said generally 3 to 5 years for that one.
Yeah, that's correct.
And so is that something UW Extension does, is test soil?
Well, yeah, well, not you know, in the physical sense of having a laboratory at all your extension offices that, you know, do the extractions and, you know, all that. But we can assist, just like we do with all kinds of different life learning topics. We can offer information on how to collect the soil sample. There's a publication for gardeners and farmers on the protocol and the proper methods for collecting that representative soil sample. And then there's usually an information sheet that has to be filled out that goes along with that soil sample. There's usually a pricing guide that we include in our soil test information kit. And you can send that. There are private labs that are certified in the state of Wisconsin that you can send those to, or you can send them to the UW-Madison or UW-Extension soil testing lab and get them analyzed through that state lab as well. So you can find that information online just by doing an internet search on soil testing lab, you know, UW-Madison or soil testing lab, UW-Extension, and there'll be buttons that'll, you know, click on for information on how to collect a sample or submit a sample. So it's fairly straightforward process. You know, obviously the ground has to be thawed. I know in the northern part of the state, winter is here, so we've kind of missed that opportunity. But if you still can get a probe or a trowel, a little shovel into the soil and collect that sample, fall is a really good time to collect that. And again, just follow the protocols on those information sheets. The cost, I believe, for the state lab is $15 for garden samples. And if you're doing, you know, agricultural fields and larger scale, I think the cost is $7 or $8 per sample.
Great. And you mentioned a publication. Would that be in the UW Extension Learning Store?
Yes, it would.
All right. We'll make sure we get a link up to that for soil testing through the Learning Store. And I would recommend people kind of browse around in the Learning Store, too, because there are, what, 200-300 publications all focused on gardening?
Oh, yes.
At least.
Yes.
So lots of great information there.
Yes, there are.
Harriet in Muscadet has a question for you, Kevin. So let's go back to the phones. Hi, Harriet.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, when I took samples of my 8 raised beds, I did not get down into the natural soil, which is not the best, obviously. That's, you know, most of the reason why you build raised beds. But anyway, how concerned should I be that I did not do that?
You know, we do have to acknowledge that the subsoil does have an influence on, you know, plants' ability to take up nutrients, and they do, you know, plant roots can, you know, go down several feet and get into that subsoil, and we know that there are nutrients, certainly water, and other benefits to that subsoil, but by and large, most of the concentrated nutrients that, I guess, have the most significant impact are going to be in that, you know, that top soil layer, you know, again, that top foot or so. And, you know, when we do test, we're usually collecting most, you know, most of our soil from that area. So the subsoil, like I said, we acknowledge that. For garden soil tests, I don't think the soil testing laboratories and the recommendations that are given necessarily take some of that into account. Certainly on our agricultural fields, that subsoil is extremely important, and we require that there be a soil name associated with the soil test report so that they can then account for some of that subsoil fertility and influence. But in a garden situation, I don't think that's necessarily built into the recommendation. But again, most of our garden crops are fairly shallow rooted, and the soil test in that top layer is going to be, give us a pretty good handle on what we need to do.
Kevin, might it matter too how deep the raised bed is, because it could be anywhere from 6 inches to 3 feet?
Well, sure. And, again, when we get into these garden situations, we're creating kind of an artificial soil. I mean, it's not one that's been developed over, hundreds of years and has a soil profile like we'd find out on the landscape. So it's somewhat, manufactured, like I said. Mm-hmm. And if it's uniform and the mixing and everything that went into that raised bed is similar from 6 inches down to 2 feet, then that subsoil is going to be very similar. That may not be the case all the time, but again, I think, for most testing, we can just concentrate on that rooting zone, that top, 6 to 10 mm-hmm. inches or so.
All right. Thanks, Harriet. And actually, that reminded me, too, Kevin, I have seen do-it-yourself soil tests, sold in garden centers and things like that. Are those also good, or do you really recommend sending it into a lab?
Well, I encourage people to, if they want to invest in a home soil test kit and do the protocols that are outlined in those kits, I'm in favor of that, because it just means people have an interest in, learning more about their soil through a soil test, whether that be, sending it to a laboratory or doing it at home with these home soil test kits. The challenge comes is, what do you do with that number that you get? Again, there's these assumptions that, the pH indicator dye or the meter you're using is calibrated and gives us a fairly, accurate representation of what that pH is or what that, phosphorus number is. But, what do you do with that number? It's a good indicator. And it can be useful, and for monitoring and just kind of keeping tabs on things, they're great. But, the question is, what do you do with that information once you, read it mm-hmm. from the little indicator strip or the dial? You've got to interpret that, and that's where I think going through a laboratory, you get a little better handle on what those recommendations are, because there's other things that they do in a laboratory that they can't do with these home soil test kits.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. And Ed in Kenosha is up next. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Hi. And thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Two kind of broad categories that I'd like to just touch base on, both kind of indirectly dealing with kind of deciduous forests. The first deals with earthworms. I had heard from the DNR that there are no native earthworms anymore in Wisconsin, that they're all invasives. So the first category of questions deals with, should we be encouraging earthworms? And in the absence of earthworms, what in the ecosystem would fill that niche? And the other question will deal with microbiota.
All right. And Kevin, I will say that we have had Bernie Williams from the DNR on. Mm-hmm. She is the invasive earthworm queen.
Yes, she is.
And mm-hmm. we have had her on. I can repost a link to that program. And actually, there was an article, too, talking about the Asian crazy worm that is now in Wisconsin. I think a lot of us kind of feel rocked, because we were always told that worms were so good mm-hmm. for the soil. So how do we kind of balance those things?
Right. And I think, this is where we have to put the right lens and perspective on some of these subjects. And, in the backyard and in more urban settings and where the deciduous native forests have long been logged over and urbanized or turned into agriculture, worms are pretty indicative of, the biology that we find in our soil. They're everywhere, and we've kind of, like you said, associated that with a positive, because they do recycle nutrients and they form these channels, and they, there's lots of benefits. But because they have such a voracious appetite for organic material, You put those in an environment that didn't evolve or didn't, you know, have earthworms like our deciduous forest, then earthworms can actually have a negative impact on that ecosystem. And that's exactly why, you know, we have this kind of debate about, well, are they good or are they bad? And, you know, it depends kind of thing. So
it depends where they are and what they're doing.
Yeah, and, you know, it's they're here just like a lot of invasives. We're not going to eradicate them. I think we just have to acknowledge that in those more pristine, native, natural, forested, you know, environments, they definitely have an impact on, you know, other plants on the forest floor. So, you know, that's just the unintended consequences of some of these things. As far as what replaces earthworms, you know, in these native forested soil situation, you know, again, it's a completely different ecosystem, and there's a plethora of these mycorrhizal fungal molds, you know, the bacteria, the springtails, you know, some of the sow bugs and, you know, mites. I think that environment tends to have, you know, the opportunity for those things to kind of work the soil in a way similar to what an earthworm might. Obviously, they're not going to channel, you know, have great big macro channels, but there's still plenty of biology there to do what the soil needs to have happen.
And Ed, you had a second question?
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
I'm glad you used the word mycorrhizae. So that was the next question. I'm working at trying to reclaim some former farmland into a woodlot. I'm aware that the deciduous forests tend to be more fungally dominated. The area is too big to get bags of leaves. Are there any thoughts about whether one should inoculate the soil with some fungus? And if so, aside from wood chips, other things to do to kind of foster that growth?
All right. Thanks, Ed. Kevin?
Well, yes, this is where, you know, we know what we know, and based off of that scientific knowledge, we're trying to use that to our advantage and encourage some of these properties that happen in more natural settings. And the mycorrhizal fungal mat that, and it's a symbiotic relationship that happens between the fungus and the tree root. And not all trees have this mycorrhizal association. And I'm not an expert by any means in any of this, but, you know, I guess, you know, with that information, you know, we can perhaps encourage that. And again, it's that decomposition of that organic matter, and these fungal, you know, mycorrhizal organisms need a food source. So, you know, if we can provide that through adding organic matter, such as your leaves or the wood chips, like you suggested, that would be, you know, I think a positive thing to do. Whether or not that attracts the right kind of fungus, the mycorrhizal kind of fungus, I don't know. You know, we can inoculate soils with different organisms, but now that gets into that whole concept of how do you know what's in that inoculum,
right?
And is it viable? And you know, you can, I'm sure, read up on the internet, and there's companies and different industries or businesses that, you know, specialize in these things. And I say, you know, you can always give it a try and just put on your thinking cap to make sure that this all makes sense and that it's something that's worth the effort.
It sounds a little like how truffles only grow at the foot of certain kinds of trees.
It's a mystery.
Yes, exactly. A delicious mystery. Arliss in Fredonia is next. Hi, Arliss.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, my question is, he mentioned something about weeds or the plants that grow in certain areas that indicate the health of the soil. If he could, like, can I determine by what weeds grow in a certain area how healthy it is? And also my, like, I have a lot of lamb's quarters I like to harvest, but some places in my garden, raised bed gardens, there will be like a red tinge to them, and they just don't look very healthy. So I just wondered what that indicates.
Sure.
And also, there's all these different minerals, like basalt rock and zeolite and azomite, and are they all kind of the same, or can you just...
Sure. Sure. And Kevin, we only have a couple minutes, so if you could, are there any weeds that indicate the health or unhealthiness of a soil?
Yeah, indicator plants. This is a whole other topic for discussion. Could have a whole show on this, I'm sure. And, you know, plants, obviously, you know, they can tell us something about their environment. And, you know, the challenge with plants is that they're so adaptable, and you know, you can find them in so many different environments, you know, and weeds in particular, that's what they make their living off of. So I'm not, you know, real up on the specifics of indicator plants, but I know a lot of gardeners and biodynamic kind of farmers rely on them as a way to, you know, monitor things. But you know, it still kind of gets back to that ecosystem that they're in. And whenever we see different colorations, like you mentioned on the lamb's quarter, you know, perhaps it's something to do with the pH or other, you know, physical or chemical properties of that soil. I've seen that myself. I don't know exactly what's going on there, but there's got to be some association that gets back to the soil there. And the soil minerals, there's, you know, now you're talking geology and all the unique qualities that are in that that geology that's associated with soils and soil minerals. And there are all kinds of nutrients that come from these different minerals. The challenge is, are they available to the plant? And, you know, you can put the green sand and the bauxite and all these other, you know, minerals on your soil, but are they going to be in a form that the plant can access?
Mm-hmm. So whether it's actually accessible to them or not. Well, Kevin Chesso, great information about soil health here on Garden Talk. We really appreciate you sharing that with us. Kevin is with UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. And we're always happy to have him with us on Garden Talk. Friday means Garden Talk, and today we're visiting with one of the great UW Extension horticulture and agriculture agents. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. So glad to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin Chesso is the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. He has a special interest in soil ecology and composting. We've been talking a lot about how to make our soils more healthy and how important that is. But Kevin can also answer your general gardening questions as well. And Kevin, thanks again for spending time with us today.
Oh, this is a pleasure.
I really like talking about soil. I can tell you do too. What a surprise, since that's your specialty. Well, we have some open lines, and I'd like to invite our listeners to join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And we do have a Facebook comment from someone I think you will know. Pam says, "Hi, Kevin. I'm in your Master Gardener class and just got my soil test bag. The flower beds around the house are extremely high in phosphorus. We water from a small river that cuts through a lot of farmland before it gets to us. Could this be the cause of the high phosphorus, or would it be from the weed and feed we've used in the past, though we are careful not to get it on the beds? What negative impact does this pose, and what can we do about the high phosphorus?"
Oh, well, Pam, you get extra points, extra credit.
Well, so. And actually, we should mention that Master Gardeners do get continuing education credit for listening to Garden Talk.
You bet they do.
So there you go.
Yes, and we took advantage of that and sent out an email yesterday. Lorraine Toman, our support staff at the Extension office and the research station, did that for me and reminded Master Gardeners that On Garden Talk is a wonderful way to get your continued education hours, and I know a lot of Master Gardeners across the state use this as an opportunity to get their continued education in. So, Pam, yes, your soil test. I'm glad you received them, and I'm glad you took some time to think about this. And you're right, high phosphorus is something that is quite common, especially in our garden soils. And now we have to ask the question, you know, so what? And what does that mean? Most of the phosphorus is going to be, you know, tied up and held onto the soil particles so it doesn't leach out. It doesn't easily get removed from the soil. So phosphorus is one of those nutrients that tends to accumulate over time. And there's many, you know, sources of phosphorus. It can be native to the soil and the soil mineralogy. We know that from, you know, just testing soils all over the state. We also know that anytime we add amendments, you know, organic fertilizers or commercial fertilizers, the weed and feed you mentioned, and possibly it could come from surface waters that you use for irrigation. So to pinpoint the source, you know, I can't really say one has a greater influence over the other, but I would tend to speculate that, you know, the commercial fertilizers that we often use in gardens are higher concentrated and as a result will elevate our soil test level. So, you know, what does this mean? I guess, you know, I would encourage anybody who's gotten a soil test that has excessively high phosphorus to contemplate, do you really need to add any more? And, you know, the common recommendation, and we do this quite often, is to recommend a complete fertilizer like a, you know, a 10-10-10, and that 10 represents the percentage of phosphorus in that mix. So, you know, the middle number is the phosphate, and you can purchase fertilizers that do not have any phosphorus in them, and we highly recommend people consider doing that. Because why put more phosphorus into the environment or into the soil than is needed, especially if your soil test indicates you've got plenty of it there? So it's really not toxic at those high levels. I mean, you don't have to worry about any of that. It just is an indication that you've got plenty of it, and now what can you do to reduce or rethink some of that phosphorus fertilizing that you may have been doing?
Thanks for that question. And we also had a question from Wesley in La Crosse. Earlier, you had mentioned that crops like blueberries like a much more acidic soil. And Wesley would like to know what he should do or add to make soil more acidic for those kinds of crops.
Yeah. You know, again, if you do a soil test and your soil test report comes back, you know, pick a pH above 5, you know, 5.5 or 6, you know, with that recommendation, with that soil test comes the recommendations if you specified you're interested in growing blueberries. And based on that soil test, they will give you some recommendations on how much of a nutrient to apply to change that pH. The common nutrient or element is sulfur. Elemental sulfur, aluminum sulfate, anything with the sulfur in it will actually react with the hydrogen that's in the soil and cause a weak, you know, it's kind of a sulfuric acid, and it attracts the hydrogen to that sulfur, and that's what causes the pH to go down. So sulfur is commonly used. You can do muriatic acid or some of these other acidifying type of fertilizers. If you want to do it more naturally, you know, that's when we look at using other acidifying agents. The peat mosses, again, you have to know the source of that peat moss to know whether or not it's actually acid. Peat moss is oftentimes acidic and can be used to, you know, lower the pH. You can bring in acid soil from another source to lower that pH. The question is, you know, are other things like pine needles, we often hear that pine needles are a good way to acidify your soil. And yes, there are, you know, hydrogen or acid associated with that. But the longer those pine needles sit and kind of compost or age, some of that acidity is removed. And they're really not, as good at acidifying the soil as most people think. But
and am I remembering that they actually take quite a while to break down, too?
Oh, yeah. Pine needles are, you know, wonderful mulch. I mean, pine straw. I mean, down south, they use pine straw is everywhere because of their loblolly pines and some of their forest industries down there, you know, a lot of pine. So, yeah, pine straw, if you got pines in your backyard, rake that up and use it for mulch. Just let it kind of age a little bit before you spread it around.
Talking with Kevin Schesso, he's the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties on Garden Talk. And we're talking a lot about soil health, but also other garden questions as well. Taylor in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Taylor.
Hi. For years, people were saying not to mix the wood, say in mulches and things, into the soil because the microbes that break down the wood use up the nitrogen and leave it depleted of nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last few years, I've been hearing that you need the wood to encourage the fungus and then thus create a symbiotic relationship with the fungus and the plants, and that you actually, it's a benefit. And so I'm curious, does having wood mixed into the soil give you a net gain or a net loss of nitrogen?
Good question. Thanks, Taylor.
Yes, I mean, you're correct. Wood chips, especially those that are extremely high in carbon, which most wood chips are, because of that carbon-to-nitrogen ratio and the fact that they are so high in carbon, that's a food source for the microorganisms. You know, they feed on that carbon. It's a main part of their diet. But just like us, you know, we need to have a balanced diet. We can't just live on carbohydrates. We need protein and minerals and other things in our diet. So microorganisms will scavenge and look around for other nutrients to, you know, complete their life cycle and keep chewing on all that carbon. So nitrogen is a part of their nutrient needs, and, you know, they'll assimilate that into their structures, and, you know, that's how they do their thing. But if there's not enough available nitrogen in that soil, they will actually scavenge it, and they can take it away, you know, in the short term from our plants. So that's why we have to caution people about using wood chips because of that ability to tie up nitrogen from our plants. Eventually, you know, it may take several years, but eventually that as those microorganisms break down that carbon, they die, the nutrients, the nitrogen that's in their bodies will be released and become available to the plants again. But in the short term, they can actually take it away. So it depends on your soil and how rich it already is. I mean, if there's plenty of nitrogen there to satisfy the microbial needs to break down that wood fiber and to supply nitrogen to our plants, you can kind of have both going on at the same time. But if you don't have that nitrogen-rich or other ways to provide nitrogen to your plants, you can actually, you know, starve your plants of that nitrogen, again, in the short term as it takes, you know, time for that carbon and those wood chips to break down.
Thanks for that call, Taylor. And I wanted to let our listeners know, Kevin, that Cheryl did get the link up to the Learning Stores publication about soil testing. So that's up on the Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show. And Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. I often get questions on that. So The Larry Mealer Show. Also, as I think we said, people can just Google UW Extension Learning Store and find that information and a whole lot more about gardening and also commercial growing as well. We have other callers on the line, Kevin, but I want to make sure that we get to, you like to say, add more till less. And I know that's that kind of sums up your philosophy. So what does add more till less mean
yes,
for you?
Right. You know, by the add more, I mean add more amendments, particularly organic matter. And there's lots of ways we can do that. You know, we've talked already about the compost and the composted manures and organic mulches, you know, pine straw, leaves, leaf mold, cover crops. I mean, all that results in adding organic matter. So add organic matter, so add more. And the till less is basically, you know, we don't want to over till and pulverize our soil and that microscopic community. We don't want to obliterate that by, you know, running our rototiller through there any more than we need to. I'm a big fan of going to raised beds. and, you know, concentrating your compaction, your walking paths, and then where the plants are grown, you know, you reach in and you may be using a fork or a smaller tiller to kind of mix in those organic amendments. So really trying to, you know, make less aggressive tilling to help that soil community and the biology do its thing. So, yeah, that's my four more words before I go is add more, till less.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. And Marion in Windsor is up next. Hi, Marion.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering what the typical or desirable pH is for rhubarb to do its best. And the other question is, what about these coffee grounds that are available at some coffee stores that they produce many of? I've been putting some of them, you know, just sprinkling them on the garden soil and also putting some in the compost heap. What do you think of those two things?
All right. Thanks, Marion. And Kevin, what about that rhubarb?
Well, most plants in general do well when our pH is somewhere between 6 and 7. 7 being, you know, neutral on the pH scale of 0 to 14. So if you're in that slightly acidic range of, you know, 6, 6.5, for nearly all of our garden plants, that'll be just fine. Once we get a little lower than that, that's when we have to worry about, you know, nutrients being tied up and no longer available to the plant. So with rhubarb, I don't, you know, I'd have to, you know, look that up, but, you know, there are pH ranges, desirable ranges for, you know, almost all of our vegetable and, you know, agricultural crops. So we know, you know, what their desired range is. But my guess is that for rhubarb, you know, if you're in that 6, you know, pH of 6 as a target, you're probably just fine. As far as the coffee grounds, coffee grounds are, you know, often touted as an organic source of nutrients, and you know, there's a lot of benefits to adding coffee grounds to our soil. Obviously, there's that organic material, the carbon, and you know, the other nutrients that are in that that will feed our biology. But we also know that there's nutrients in coffee grounds, and I just happen to have a little chart here that shows that again, a book value or an average amount of nitrogen in coffee grounds is almost 2 pounds percent. So about 1.9% of coffee grounds by weight is nitrogen, and there's about 0.5% of phosphorus and potassium in those coffee grounds. So not only is it providing the organic matter and feeding our soil biology, but it also has nutrients in the form of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So coffee grounds are a good thing.
All right. Thanks for that call, Marion. And back to the phones and Bob in Onalaska. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Yeah, see, we've got a cabin up in Black River where it's quite sandy. And, well, the main thing is that we've sort of cut down some trees and different things that we have. But my wife has me rake all the time, and then she hauls these leaves to the dump. And, man, it's a big job, and I'm just wondering if that's a good thing to do and what I could do instead. So I was going to maybe make I got a big cyclone fence that I could put, you know, leaves in and try to make a compost pile. But I'm wondering if you just pile leaves in, it's mainly oak and pine and stuff, if you just pile leaves in, will that eventually turn to mulch if you had a great big high area to put it in? And we might even have more leaves than what that thing could carry. So I'm just wondering what to do, because she's raking all the time. I mean, she's raking this just like we're at, you know, at our house.
Okay.
Sure. Well, you're on the right track. We have to recognize that, you know, that's free organic matter, free potential nutrients. You know, it's right there on site. The question is, how do you manage that so that you can turn that into a valuable garden resource or a soil amendment? And, you know, mulch mowing, just, you know, shredding those leaves up and leaving them on the soil to begin with, would be one way to think about this. Now, you know, depending on how thick that leaf layer is in the fall and how much smothering it does of the lawn or the other plants that are you're trying to manage as your lawn or, you know, ground cover, that, you know, that can have a negative impact. But, you know, shredding them and just leaving them stay in place might be one option. But, again, not knowing, again, the volume and whether or not that seems reasonable. But collecting them and intentionally encouraging decomposition through, you know, putting them into a wire bin like you suggested, or even, you know, just making a pile at the edge of the property or at the edge of the woods and letting them naturally sit there. It's going to take longer, but at some point you can go back in there and use that decomposed leaf material. It's oftentimes referred to as leaf mold because it really doesn't break down to that black composted type material very quickly. So, you know, in a matter of months, you can get it partially broken down. And now you've got a wonderful mulch you can use to spread around the base of your trees or to cover your rhubarb or your perennials or use it as a garden mulch. So I'm a huge fan of utilizing leaves in the fall, but it does require change of habit and you got to have a place to put them. I simply just make windrows, run over them with a push lawnmower that's got a bagger on it, and then dump them into a wire bin. I'll add a little water. Maybe I'll add some other nitrogen in there if I want. But I'm basically speeding up that decomposition. And leaf mold is a fantastic mulch to use. And I encourage you to just think about ways to make it convenient and simple.
All right.
That's the challenge.
Good luck, Bob. We have just a few minutes left, Kevin, and we had both a caller and a commenter on Facebook asking about how to amend soil to get lawns growing well, especially when there are some bare spots.
Well, now we get into that crime scene investigation. We have to think about why is that lawn not doing well and what's causing the bare spots, you know, and that will lead us to making some of those decisions on what to do. You know, if it is, you know, a soil deficiency or there's some issues going on with the soil, you know, again, you know, can you do a soil test of that area to maybe determine if that's an issue? But you really need to think about why that lawn is thinning out and not doing well in the first place. You know, it could be sunlight. You know, it could be pH. You know, there's a reason why that turf is not doing well in that spot. So that's where that soil test comes into play. But, you know, once you've done that soil test and you know what the results of that are, you know, there may be a deficiency there that can be corrected through either commercial or organic type amendments. And, you know, gets back to healthy soil equals healthy plants and, you know, do an investigation of that area. And, you know, maybe it will benefit by, you know, improving the soil by adding that leaf mold that I just mentioned or sprinkling some compost or mixing in some, you know, potting soil or other quality topsoil into that area and then reseeding. But it really gets back to what's causing the turf to be in decline in the first place. So you got to do your CSI.
All right. Get out there with, well, maybe not with a magnifying glass, but with your with your soil collection things. And again, to remind people, there is a link on Facebook to the UW Extension information about how to take a soil test. And you know, it sounds like, Kevin, that's a really good first step, no matter what you're growing or how big a spot you've got.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a saying, you know, we have is take the test, you know, don't guess. You know, get that baseline information. You know, it's not the end all. It only will tell you certain things, you know, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, organic matter. You can do micronutrients. You know, the other thing that I didn't really talk about is, you know, what is the future of soil testing? And I can see the day where you will have the option to do a bioassay and analyze your soil for some of these important microorganisms, especially as we learn more about the role they play. So, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to understanding some of this stuff.
And we're going to have to leave it there because we are out of time. Kevin Chesso, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Glad to be back.
Thank you. Kevin Chesso is with UW Extension, and we're always happy to have him, and we're always happy to have you join us on Garden Talk.